Again, we go into part two of the concept or the understanding of the framework of reconciliation. Last week, we started with part one, as I stated, it's more than just what some people would refer to as the three-step process. The three-step process is something that, again, people will commonly refer to as going to your brother, where you go to him first. If he will not hear you, then you take a witness. If he still will not hear you, then you go to the church. But again, as I stated, it's part, true reconciliation is part of a seven-part process. Now, last week, we covered the first four. If any of you are listening right now and have no idea what I'm talking about, if you go online, you can find that sermon online either at our website, the Auckland Kagwa TV Auckland site. You can also go to Kagwa members in the sermons, and that sermon itself is listed there as well. We covered the first four steps of the seven-step process last week. The first one was attitude, and again, having humility. Jesus Christ, as you remember, would use the small child to show the proper attitude as we would come, before we could ever come forward to the individual again and deal with whatever the situation was. The second step was not to give offense. And Jesus Christ showed that how giving offense is likened to sin. None of us wants to sin. And so again, his point was, don't bring offense, because that would be, in effect, giving sin. The third step we showed was respect, showing respect. That means, again, esteeming someone better than ourselves, coming at that from a standpoint of trying to find reconciliation with the person rather than going into an all-out war and a battle, believing that I'm right, you're wrong, and if you don't see it my way, there's something wrong with you. So again, esteeming someone better than ourselves. And then the fourth step was, again, finally, privacy. Privacy has to do with seeking that first step in private, one-on-one. And again, not taking it into public, not taking it into a group of individuals, but seeking in private the ability to go one-on-one with an individual. From there, we move into the part two of framework of reconciliation. So let's go to Matthew chapter 18. Matthew chapter 18, and we're going to pick up step five. Now, what we're going to find in step five is the point of seeking help, but we're also going to find that it's all sort of part of going into that privacy where we're seeking the sort of first step of going to the individual in private. I say the first step of the three within the seven, talking about going to the individual and dealing with whatever the problem might be. So Matthew chapter 18, we deal once again here, we'll pick it up in verse 15, which again is where we left off last time. Matthew chapter 18, beginning in verse 15, he says, "Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone." Remember what we said? We talked about privacy and the need for privacy. "If he hears you, you have gained your brother." So clearly Christ is saying, if, not he's going to, because in some cases it may be a situation where the individual is not going to listen to the other person. It would be great if things were short-circuited right there and there could be reconciliation. Everybody came together and everything was wonderful and hunky and dory and let's go sit by a campfire and eat s'mores and sing Kumbaya. But we also know that human beings and human nature don't always operate in that particular fashion. And so sometimes it necessitates us taking what we would refer to as the second step of these three that are inserted in the middle of the seven-step process of reconciliation. Let's pick it up in verse 16. He says, "But if he will not hear, take with you one or two more, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word may be established." So we've moved from the point of privacy and going to that person one-on-one. He has not heard us. And so now what Christ is saying, at this point, you need to take one or two individuals. Now, it's very important to understand who the two individuals, the one or two individuals that you would take. Is it going to be someone that's going to be part, if you're coming to the person, is it going to be one or two of the individuals that are your posse? In other words, they're your hitmen, and they think just the way you do, so you want to put the nail in this guy's coffin or this gal's coffin. You know, I'm going to get my way, so I'm going to choose someone that thinks just the way I do. Again, part of human nature is when we want what we want, we're going to take the individuals that will give us the support of what we want done. It's kind of like seeking counsel from someone, right? If I want to do something and I know that I need to seek counsel, if I really want to do it, am I going to take someone that's give me the counsel and say, you know what, you really shouldn't do that? I'm going to try and seek the counsel that's going to get me to do what I want to do and it's going to agree with what I want to do. This particular step in seeking help, which is step five, seeking help, again, one needs to be careful when enacting this step. Healing and making amends takes time. And so we don't want to jump the gun, as the proverbial saying is. Usually that's related to track and field. When you're in the blocks and the starter's pistol and you've got what's called a false start, you take off before the gun sounds. We don't want to jump the gun. Oftentimes we have to come to an understanding where the witnesses serve to calm and settle things down. As I like to use the term, everybody needs to take a deep breath here. Calm down. The best reason for taking time is that one can spend more time in prayer and fasting, because ultimately, remember, what is it that we're trying to reach? We're trying to reach restoration of the relationship between a couple of individuals. And so we want for that true restoration to take place. We need to give it time. If we go to somebody in private on a Sunday and we don't feel like they've responded by the Monday, we don't say, let me get a couple of witnesses and talk to you on the Tuesday. You've got to give it some time. There's other reasons as well for taking witnesses and seeking help on this particular fifth step of the seven-step process. Perhaps the individual didn't hear because they were in denial. That's possible. But by bringing in a second or third witness, you know, they may not have wanted to hear it from you. But when you bring in a couple other people that this individual might know and say, well, wait a minute, if those people feel the same way that this guy feels, maybe I need to reevaluate this. Maybe I need to think about this. Maybe I didn't listen because I didn't like the person coming to me and telling me that I had sinned against them or offended them in some way. Perhaps it wasn't presented clearly. That's the other situation that can happen and occur. Sometimes we have an inability to articulate ourselves. I've had that situation happen before when I'm talking to someone, not in a particular situation, but as I'm trying to explain something to someone, you know, and someone looks at me and I can see this puzzled look on their face, and I say, I'm not explaining this correctly. I'm not explaining this in a way that I can help you understand. So I'm not putting the onus back on them. I'm putting the onus on myself, saying perhaps it wasn't presented correctly. If I'm the individual going to the other person, approaching them, maybe I didn't present it correctly or clearly in a fashion, in a way that they can understand. Again, part of the reason for bringing in the witnesses. And of course, the third part of this particular one is perhaps the person we're going to is actually innocent. Perhaps they're actually innocent. Perhaps this is a situation of, we use the term bad blood. You've heard that term, a slang term. You've got something against somebody because of something from the past, whatever it might be. And so it's built up over a period of time. And so there's bad blood. And maybe in this particular instance, the individual is actually innocent. These witnesses can then come into the situation and provide the means by which we would move then to the next step. In other words, again, going to the point of simply saying, okay, yes, we need to talk to the particular individual. I've had to be involved in this step when I was simply a lay member way back many moons ago. I remember, this goes all the way back to the Worldwide Church of God, and an individual that, again, a friend and I, the three of us were friends, we knew each other. We had what I felt was a fairly close relationship. And the one individual was a friend, came to me and he said, do you know so-and-so is doing the following in his business? Again, it was an egregious situation that was occurring and going on, a situation that could actually get him arrested. And so we went to him as brothers, trying to get him to understand You can't do this. This is something contrary to the very teachings of the Bible. Now, it didn't go well. That's the other side of the story. But somewhere down the line, he did repent, because to this day, he's still a member of the church. But at that particular moment in time, again, it didn't go well. But my point being here is that when the witnesses come in, they can affirm the situation. They can say, yes, this situation did occur. Yes, the facts were laid out. Yes, the conversation did take place. And that is important when we seek help going to the third step in this sort of three-step process of seeking help. I hope I'm not confusing everybody when I talk about the third process in the seven-step processes. Because the seeking help is going privately, one-on-one, then the witnesses. And now we come to verse 17, where we now are going to talk about bringing the church into play. Matthew chapter 18 and verse 17, he says, and if he refuses, in other words, we've already gone to the one-on-one, we've brought one or two witnesses, and the person still refuses. Verse 17, he says, and if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. But if he refuses even to hear the church, let him be to you like a heathen and a tax collector. Now, this particular point has also been somewhat abused over the past probably 30 years. Now, when I say that, we look at the term that is used here where it says, and if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. I remember years ago, and again, I won't tell you where it was many, many years ago. And again, sitting there in a meeting with my elders in a particular church area, and one of the elders' wives, as we were having just some banter and conversation at this elders' meeting, brought up the point about Matthew chapter 18, and what do we do when something is said contrary to what Scripture says? And I said, well, what are you talking about? Well, the individual had talked about the point, well, we had been gone to another church area the week before, and it was one of those church areas that was 4.5 hours away, and so long before the days of the internet and webcasting, and so this particular individual got up and gave a sermonette. Well, I was not there, and gave this particular sermonette. The other elder was not there either, gave the sermonette, and talked about the three steps, and about going to your brother, and then taking witnesses. And if he won't hear you, then you got to go to the church. You got to tell everybody in the church this person's problems. And I looked up. My face probably went white. If there had been a video camera there, my face would have gone white. And I said, what? I said, are you making that up? Are you just saying that for a rise out of me? And her husband's right there. He said, no, that's what he said. I said, no, that is not what we mean by taking it to the church. We'll talk about that in a moment. Before we would ever want to bring this particular part of seeking help into this particular problem, we'd have to ask the question, have you gone to your brother? Have you followed the previous steps? Now, there are certain instances where we simply know that that cannot be the case. Well, I wouldn't go too far into the specifics here, but there are certain things that would happen and occur where you don't necessarily are going to go through step one, step two, and finally bring it to the ministry. If there is an example or something that is happening of heresy or insurrection in a congregation or in the church, that would be something that would have to be dealt with quickly and speedily by the ministry. So again, there are certain things that you look at. But again, as we're talking about a particular situation that's not involved with that, we're talking about a situation of one-on-one with a couple of individuals. We understand and recognize that the church and Jesus Christ, the apostles, all in their writings talk specifically about what needs to be done at that particular moment of the third step of seeking help, which is step five. Let's turn over to 2 Thessalonians chapter 6 here for a moment. You can hold your place in Matthew 18. We'll be back in a moment. 2 Thessalonians chapter 6, and let's notice verse 6. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 6. We're going to look at two verses here, verses 6 and verse 14. Let's start with verse 6 first of all. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 6. The Apostle Paul speaking here, he says, "But we command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you withdraw from every brother who walks disorderly and not according to the tradition which he received from us." Now, who is Paul saying is us? He's talking about the ministry. He's talking about the ministry. He's talking about the teachings that they have given. If they're walking contrary, don't follow them. If they're walking disorderly in terms of doctrine and fundamental belief, don't follow them. Paul's making that clear. Drop down to verse 14. He says, "And if anyone does not obey our word in this epistle, note that person and do not keep company with him, that he may be ashamed." Now, you know, someone might look at that and think, well, that's pretty drastic. Well, again, we're talking about an instance here where this could be heresy, could be insurrection. It could be an individual that's seeking to cause division. And anytime there's division, anytime there's something contrary, again, to the church and the welfare of the church, Paul is simply saying, don't keep company with that person. When it comes to certain things like this, it can be a very delicate matter where the church is involved. And again, on a broader scale in terms of dealing with some of these things in terms of discipline. In every case that I've ever been involved with in all of my time in the ministry, it was always done, first of all, to try and bring the person to a better understanding of themselves and the problem they were in. But also then, number two, to protect the congregation from the individual who chose not to, again, change the behavior. Again, important when we come back and understand these things. So we also understand and recognize that there's a need also to be aware that something can become a root of bitterness. And this is something that can cause further trouble and lead to someone actually exiting the church. Let's turn over to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 15. Actually, we'll pick it up in verse 14. Hebrews chapter 12, let's start in verse 14, and let us talk about verses 14 and 15. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 14, he says, "Pursue peace with all people." That's a tall call. Especially when someone's as prickly as a porcupine, you know? How do you pick somebody up who's prickly as a porcupine? Well, avoid the quails, you know? You still pick them up. And what was the, I can't remember who it was. I think it was Joel Meeker years ago gave a sermon on the paradoxical Ten Commandments. You know, you're supposed to love everyone. What happens if you can't love them? Well, love them anyway. What if they're difficult to love? Love them anyway. What if they make it hard to love them? Love them anyway. You know, it's difficult. It's difficult. Pursue peace with all people and holiness without which no one will see the Lord. Verse 15, looking carefully lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled. So again, there could be a root of bitterness that is set up, and we again don't want to get to that point where it becomes a bigger problem for the person, but also not becoming a bigger problem for the congregation as well. This is a step, talking about first, the third part here of step five, seeking help. This third part cannot be used. It cannot be used until the other two steps have been exhausted. We cannot short circuit it. Again, I give you a personal example. I had an individual years ago that was the individual as simply a tattletale. Do you know this person's doing this? Do you know this person's doing that? I thought, why are you telling me? If it's a problem, then it's happened to you, then you need to go and talk to them one-on-one. Well, that's your job in the ministry. I'm like, my friend, go back to Matthew chapter 18. You're trying to short-circuit the process. All you are at this particular moment is a tattletale. Again, do I get personally involved? Does the ministry get personally involved? Not until the other two steps have been exhausted. If someone came to me and said, I have a problem with Joe Smith, the first thing I'm going to say is, what have you done to resolve it? What have you done to resolve it? Have you gone to Joe Smith? Have you taken one or two witnesses to Joe Smith? Have you dealt one-on-one with Joe Smith? Have you followed the principles of Matthew 18 with Joe Smith? How long has this thing been going on? How long have you taken before you brought it to me? These, again, are all very important when we seek this third point of bringing it to the church. Now, let's ask the question here. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 18. Let's ask the question here. What does it mean when it says here, take it to the church? Who is the church? I told you that story of an individual who believed that, you know, once you've exhausted the first two, you just got to go tell everybody in the church this person's problems. Who is the church in this particular instance? The word ecclesia referred to here, the word church referred to in Matthew chapter 18 and verse 17 is from the Greek word ecclesia. All other New Testament uses of this word refer to the assembly of believers. We are the ecclesia. So it is thought by some that in step three, a matter has to be brought before the entirety of the members or the baptized members of the church. That is not the case. Again, years ago, in an area that I served, there were individuals that wanted to set up what I referred to as a kangaroo court. I told Mr. Van Belkom, sometimes I use these terms, and I don't know if they translate from the United States into the South Pacific. A kangaroo court is not a court from Australia. A kangaroo court is a sort of a joke of a court that is designed and set up essentially to find someone guilty before all the evidence is heard. So again, going back to this particular situation, I had an individual come to me, or a couple of individuals said, they wanted to go back because this particular individual was sitting in the congregation and a problem had occurred and they don't feel that it had been addressed correctly by the ministry. Now, this person had continued to attend and they felt it was a problem and it needed to be addressed. And I said, well, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about 3 months ago, 6 months ago? Well, come to find out it was 7 years ago. And I remember telling the person, why stop there? Why don't we go back 10, 15, 20 years ago? We start doing that, there's going to be nobody in the church, right? Because everybody at some point has had some sort of a problem, some sort of sin that they're dealing with, and coming to the particular point of saying, this is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Again, let's set up this kangaroo court so we can deal with this particular problem that was not handled correctly by the ministry. Again, the concept and idea here that the church, as this person saw it, was the members of this baptized congregation that could deal with this particular problem. And I sat there and I'm like, well, who's going to decide who's going to be on this sort of this commission or this panel of individuals? Who decides that? Well, we'll decide that. And I'm like, okay, really, you're going to decide that? Remind me never do something in this congregation if I'm a member because I'll probably get thrown out. Let's take a look at a couple of verses here that deal about this whole concept, though, of who is the church? What is the church? Paul addresses this in several scriptures that we can go back to. Let's notice, first of all, 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 11 through 13. Now, I'm going to go there pretty quickly. I've got these in my notes, so you don't need to turn there. If you want to turn there, you can, but I'm going to go very quickly because I've got them in my notes. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 11 through 13. Here's what the Apostle Paul said. This is, again, that situation of the man that was caught in an impropriate relationship with his stepmother. And notice what he says. He says, but now I have written to you not to keep company with anyone named a brother who is sexually immoral or covetousness or an idolater or a reveler or a drunkard or an extortioner, not even to eat with such a person. Was the church deciding that at Corinth? No, Paul is making the statement. I'm telling you, don't have anything to do with an individual like this. It wasn't the congregation that decided that. It was the Apostle Paul who decided that based upon what he said here. Going on, he said, For what have I to do with judging those who are outside? Do you not judge those who are inside? But those who are outside, God judges. Therefore, put away from yourself the evil person. Now again, this is after all three steps have gone through here, and the point we're trying to drive at is who is the church? Paul's addressing it as, I am the apostle. I'm telling you, don't keep company with this individual. Going on, 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 19 and 20. 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 19 and 20. Notice the Apostle Paul's statement here. He says, having faith and a good conscience, which some having rejected concerning the faith have suffered shipwreck, of whom are Hymenaeus and Alexander, whom I delivered to Satan that they may learn not to blaspheme. Did the church do that? No, he says he did that. He delivered them to Satan that they may learn not to blaspheme. Romans chapter 16 and verse 17, he says, now I urge you, brethren, note those who cause divisions and offenses contrary to the doctrine which you learned, and avoid them. In every indication here, we have an understanding that it was the Apostle Paul, it was the ministry in the New Testament church that was, again, meeting out this particular discipline that needed to take place. Let's understand something here. And again, it goes back to that example of the kangaroo court that I talked about many, many years ago. Among the membership of God's church, there are spiritual babes. We understand that. Spiritual babes who, again, in my estimation, are totally unqualified to make spiritual judgments that are binding on the church. Because as we're going to see in a moment, again in Matthew chapter 18, that God backs up the process with his government, you have an understanding that spiritual babes are unqualified to make certain spiritual judgments that are binding on the church. If you were to be judged on a matter by the church, who would you want? Would you want a person with decades of wisdom, or would you want a spiritual babe? Now, I can answer that question for myself. I'm going to want someone to adjudicate that particular matter. If I'm involved in, if I'm the side here of that decision that has to be made, I want someone with decades of wisdom to make that decision. I do not want a spiritual babe. Doesn't mean I discount them, but in the case of binding spiritual judgment, I want someone with decades of wisdom. Now let's ask the question, is this what the scriptures require? What was the practice in the early New Testament church? And again, going back to Matthew chapter 18, we see that this is exactly the context with which we saw taking the church refers to the church being the ministry. Because notice what it says, step six in the seven-step process, which is God backs up the process and his government. God backs up the process and his government. Matthew chapter 18. We just read in verse 17, if he refuses to hear, take it to the church. Who is the church? The church, again, is the leadership, the ministry. Verse 18. Assuredly, this is Jesus Christ speaking now, assuredly I say to you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Again, I say to you that if two of you agree on earth concerning anything they ask, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. The judgment that has to be made on that, in step five of that third part of the process, going to the church, is again dealing with the ministry. The ministry has certain things, certain tools in the toolbox that sometimes have to be used to the necessity of taking care of a given situation if it rises to this particular level. We know that Jesus Christ has built his church, and at no time has the church ever been without leadership. You can read for yourself in Acts chapter 14 and verse 23, Paul and Barnabas, we are told, ordained elders in every city. In Titus chapter 1 and verse 5, the Apostle Paul commanded Titus to appoint elders in every city. This has been an established practice in the church ever since. We know that elders are the recognized leaders in the church and the ones determining who should be as a heathen and a tax collector, as it referred to here in verse 17. Now, to get to this particular point is not very common. Let's understand something here. This is not very common. This is a small minority. But it's important to understand that it is sometimes something that must happen and it must occur. God exercises his authority through the elders by granting them power to make judgments. Now, I realize that some people may not like that, but that comes directly from Scripture. Sometimes it affords itself in the meanings of a suspension, and sometimes it means disfellowship. As I said, I've been involved with that before. It is never pleasant, but at the end of it all, it is always designed to bring the person back to the church in a right condition. And again, sometimes it is also for the protection of the flock as well. This is the way that God preserves unity and peace in the church when members will not accept and apply that correction. Let's turn over to Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. And again, as I said before, I recognize that, again, we deal with a little bit of a heavy subject on this particular step. But it's also important to understand the reconciliation process, because remember what the whole process is about. The process is about restoring a brother, restoring an individual. And so ultimately, that's what you're trying to do. That has to always be in the backdrop of what we're thinking about through this entire process. The sixth step of that process is God backing up that process and backing up his government. Let's notice Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 11. Notice what he says. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 11, he says, and he himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. None of us are there yet, myself included. But we work towards it, don't we? And in order to work towards it, God has established the church. Jesus Christ leads the church. And here in Ephesians 4, the Apostle Paul tells us there is a structure that exists in terms of what the church is. Who is the church? God tells us very clearly that Paul tells us very clearly here that God has appointed those individuals to pastor, to lead, to teach, to admonish, to sometimes have to make judgments in the church. It's not something that is a snap decision. It takes time. It takes gathering all of the information. But again, these are things that are important. And again, the Scriptures tell us specifically that this is how it has to function and this is how it operates. Restoration is the key. Always keep that in mind. Restoration is always the key. Never think about it as just pulling someone out of a congregation or out of a fellowship, but ultimately bringing them to the restoration of where they need to be. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 18 now for step number 7. Matthew chapter 18, and let's pick up step number 7. Now, again, here we're going to find a step that is actually going to be a parable. This particular step is titled Forgiveness Opens the Door to Reconciliation. Forgiveness opens the door to reconciliation. Now remember, we talk about the framework of reconciliation. So all of these 7 steps have to be steps that are encompassed in terms of reconciliation. Now you're sitting there and you're going, well, wait a minute, you said reconciliation. How does forgiveness play into this? Well, you cannot have reconciliation without forgiveness. Forgiveness is the first step. But it's also going to require some trust. It's also sometimes going to require some time in order for that trust to be built back in an individual. We may have harmed someone in such a way that they say, I accept your forgiveness. But it's going to take a little bit of time for me to get back to that buddy-buddy relationship that we might once have had. In his unique teaching style, Jesus Christ is going to give us a parable here that I think is most profound when it talks about forgiveness and the step of reconciliation. Let's pick it up here in Matthew chapter 18 and verse 21. Matthew chapter 18 and verse 21. This is the parable of the unforgiving servant. Verse 21, then Peter came to him and said, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to seven. Now, seven was considered the number of completion. So in Peter's mind, again, as I've said before, it was one of those situations where Peter was thinking, okay, when can I bring retribution on this particular individual? And so you almost have the feeling like he's got a little notepad there with a pencil going, that's one, that's two, oh, come on, give me seven, and that's seven, that's it. Boy, the next time you come at me, I'm not going to forgive. That's number eight, and I'm coming at you like a howitzer. I'm going to come at you as a flamethrower. What was Christ's response? The Lord said, how often my brother sin against me and forgive him? Up to seven. Jesus, verse 22, said to him, I do not say to you up to seven times, but up to 70 times seven. That's a big number, right? Can any of us honestly say that someone has sinned or offended us 490 times? They're probably not even alive anymore. You get my point. Christ was using, again, this. You get the two opposite extremes. You get seven, and he says, no, 70 times seven. You get the opposite extreme here. Now, to illustrate the need for forgiveness, he's going to, again, enter into the parable. Remember, the parable is to teach a lesson. It's a story designed to teach a lesson. And once again, in this particular parable, this particular story, Christ is going to use this teaching method of going to the extremes on either side. Verse 23, he says, therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. And when he had begun to settle accounts, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. Now, part of the problem in dealing a parable that was written around that period of time is we don't deal in the monetary function of talents or denarii. And so in order to make the parable come alive in the 21st century, we kind of need to translate it into 21st century values, things that we can come to grips with. None of us is going to see somebody today in a nice dress and say, that's a beautiful dress. I know, it only cost me 3 talents. Honey, how much did you pay for the groceries this week? Well, it cost me 4 talents. How much gas can I put in your car? Give me about 5 talents worth. We don't use that, do we? We use monetary things. So when he says that this one individual was brought before him who owed 10,000 talents, in modern day vernacular, that's about $20 million. That's a big number. $20 million. Verse 25. But as he was not able to pay, that's an understatement right there. Write me a check for $20 million. Yeah, let me get my checkbook out. Do you take Visa? He was not able to pay. Again, owe me this particular money. His master commanded that he be sold with his wife and children and all that he had, and that payment be made. Began to sell these accounts. And again, all these things. The servant, therefore, verse 26, fell down before him, saying, Master, have patience with me, and I will pay you all. You know, before I came into the ministry, you know what I did? I worked in loan resolution, loan workout. That meant having to sometimes get on the phone with someone saying, hey, your payment's due. Do you know how many times I've heard the check is in the mail? Have a little patience with me, Master. The check's in the mail. It's coming. Have patience with me, and I will pay you all. Verse 27, notice. Now, this is interesting. It tells you a little bit about the master. He must have had a lot of money, because I don't know that I'd let anybody away that owed me $20 million. I don't know that I could have that same type of forgiveness. If you're talking about the physical, right? Then the master of that servant was moved with compassion, released him, and forgave him the debt. Not the end of the story. Verse 28. But that servant, the one that was released from the $20 million of debt, he went out and found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. That's about $20. Now you see the opposite ends of the spectrum that Jesus is working here? $20 million? $20. He owed him 100 denarii. He laid hands on him and took him by the throat, saying, pay me what you owe. So his fellow servant fell down at his feet, begged him, saying, have patience with me, and I will pay you all. But he would not. See the difference in the two? This is what Christ is trying to show here. He's painting a perfect illustration. $20 million on one hand, $20 on the one hand. The man that was owed the $20 million, the master said, I'm going to let you go. The one that owed the $20 said, if you can't pay it, I'm throwing you in prison. Verse 30. He would not let him go, but went and threw him into prison till he should pay the debt. So when his fellow servants saw what he had done, they were very grieved and came and told their master all that had been done. Then his master, after he had called him, said to him, you wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you begged me. You pleaded with me. You cried to me. Should you not have also had compassion on your fellow servant, just as I had pity on you? And his master was angry, delivered him to the torturers until he should pay all that was due to him. So my heavenly Father also will do to you if each of you from his heart does not forgive his brother his trespasses. Notice carefully that statement, from the heart. It means there has got to be a realization here that we are willing to forgive. The parable is just astounding when you see how Jesus Christ again teaches this. $20 million versus $20. The guy that had the $20 million debt, I'm going to let you go. I'm going to have compassion upon you. The same person found that guy who owed him 20 bucks and says, give it to me or I'm going to throw you in prison. The point being here very clearly, forgiveness and reconciliation must come by having that attitude of being willing to forgive from the heart. The parable shows us the importance of forgiveness in the reconciliation process. Let's also understand, as I said before, forgiveness is not reconciliation. They are not the same thing. However, reconciliation can never begin until forgiveness is first given. Are there times when it may be difficult for us to reconcile? Absolutely, but forgiveness still has to be part of the equation. What if we forgive someone, but they die before we can reconcile? Well, we come back to understand that we have done our part, and ultimately we look forward to that time when we can be together with them in God's kingdom. What if the offense is grievous in terms of perhaps an individual being violent? We don't want to enter back into that particular situation unless we truly believe the person to be repentant. But make no mistake, reconciliation takes time. Trust has to be built back. Wounds have to be healed. But it must first begin with forgiveness. And I believe that's why we see the seventh step where Jesus Christ sealed the deal with showing them that parable and the importance of forgiveness. If we can paint reconciliation with the standpoint of the importance of forgiveness, then that reconciliation will come. It will take time. As I said, trust will have to be built back, but it will come. But first, the forgiveness must be there. Let's conclude by turning over to Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6. Once again, we find at the tail end of the model prayer that Jesus Christ gave, the Sermon on the Mount. Let's pick it up in verse 14 of Matthew chapter 6. He says, for if you forgive men their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men their trespasses, their sins, their iniquities, their offenses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses. Brethren, how can we possibly come before God at this year's Passover and partake of the symbols of his Son, ask that our slate, so to speak, be wiped clean, if we're not willing to make the effort to be reconciled to one another? As of today, Passover is 73 days away. The time to begin the reconciliation process is now, not a week, not a couple of days before the Passover. We will examine ourselves. We will seek forgiveness. And we will renew that which has brought us reconciliation with our God. But let us also not forget that in the beauty of this time of the year, there is a beauty and a way to examine, to forgive, and begin the road to reconciliation with our fellow brothers in the faith. Matthew chapter 18 is a beautiful passage, inspired and spoken by Jesus Christ. It's a seven-step process to reconciliation. It is a fantastic blessing that has been given for our benefit. Let's be reminded of that fact as we prepare for our Passover this year.